From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On Story features discussions with a diverse array of voices who use a language of film and television to tell a story. On today's episode, we are discussing screen adaptations of beloved books with the Glass Castle co-writer Andrew Lanham.
Something that was really beautiful about the Glass Castle is that even though it's maybe not as personal in terms of actual events from my life, I think for Destin and I both, there were a lot of qualities of the book that we had a deep personal connection to.
And Life of Pi screenwriter David McGee.
The moment that I knew Ang Lee wanted to do it, I mean, I say it in a joking way, but it's very true. If Ang Lee can make it as visually wonderful and intense as Ang Lee can do, then I have no doubt we can find a way to pull this off.
On Story will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Andrew Lanham received his MFA in screenwriting from the University of Texas in Austin. In 2010, he won the Nickel Fellowship in Screenwriting, as well as the Drama and Latitude Screenwriting Awards at the Austin Film Festival for his script, The Jumper of Maine. Lanham co-wrote the screen adaptation of Jeanette Wall's best-selling memoir, The Glass Castle, which is currently in theaters. The film stars Woody Harrelson, Naomi Watts, and Brie Larson. I spoke with Andrew Lanham on the phone ahead of the film's release. Clips from this episode copyright Lionsgate, Netter Productions, and GC Productions USA, Inc. Here's the trailer for The Glass Castle.
Rich city folk live in fancy apartments, but their air is so polluted they can't even see the stars. We'd have to be out of our minds to trade places with any of them.
Dr. Taylor said we should go to real school.
A real school, huh?
This is as real as it gets, kids. You learn from living.
Pack yourself a toothbrush, dear. Pack yourself a favorite flower.
You're gonna tell them about us?
You shouldn't be ashamed of us just because we choose a different lifestyle than you. When did you lose your sense of adventure?
If the sun don't shine.
Let's go, kids. Venture on our tails.
He means the bill collectors.
And if the subway's flat.
The kids are tired of moving to a new town every time you lose a job.
You know, all this running around is only temporary. We just need perfect location, then we can get to work on our castle.
This place doesn't have any running water or electricity.
Ignore her. She was born without vision.
My parents are squatting in an abandoned building on the Lower East Side.
Do you honestly tell me that you're happy right now?
Yes, I am.
I found grace in the black water.
We ain't like other people. We got a fire burning in our bellies.
You were born to change the world, not just add to the noise.
Why do you think all of us ran away from you? We were drowning.
I'm begging.
Never let anything bad happen to you. But I can't let you cling to the side your whole life just because you're scared.
It was your job to protect us.
You have a right to be angry. I know you love him. You'll regret it if you don't come home.
You ready?
Let's go!
I told you so.
You ain't like me.
I am like you, and I'm glad.
I wrote my first script and applied to the RTF program at UT Austin about 6 years ago, 6 or 7, and I got into that program. And when I was there, I wrote my next script and I won the Nickel Fellowship and the Austin Film Festival Screenwriting and Independent Script Awards. And so that I was still in graduate school when that happened, but that was really like my big breakthrough. And off of winning the Nickel Fellowship, I came out to LA. I got a team, like my agent and manager, and I won that at the same year as Destin Daniel Cretton, who had won with his script for Short Term 12, which he then went and made the following year. So So when I moved to LA, I lived on Destin's couch for a couple of months, and he just became a really one of the closest friends I've ever had. And about 2 years after I had moved here, which was around a year after Short Term 12 came out, Glass Castle was presented to Destin. And he just called me one day and asked if I had read it. And I had, and reread it a second time. And we just kind of started talking about it. And one thing that's great with our friendship, regardless of working together, is that we know each other really well. And we think the same way about a lot of things and have kind of the same instincts. So off of those initial conversations, he said, well, I think I'm going to pursue it, but I'm going to tell them that I'd like to write it with you, which was amazing for me, having still being working these kind of like smaller jobs. And so he presented me to the producer, and I got along well with the producer. And then we had to pitch the two of us to the studio, and they hired us. And then we were kind of off and running and working on the project. Winning Austin was also amazing for my career. Like, I never would have, everything happened because of winning those fellowships. Just regardless of work, one of the most important things that came out in my life from that fellowship was my friendship with Destin, because he had already lived here and has like a big family and lots of friends and stuff. But then in a kind of really, really beautiful way, that kind of led to this working relationship as well. The Jumper of Maine was very personal to me, but something that was really beautiful about the Glass Castle is that even though it's maybe not as personal in terms of actual events from my life, I think for Destin and I both, there were a lot of qualities of the book that we had a deep personal connection to. I think one of the things that's really beautiful about Jeanette's story is she took all of these kind of larger than life, like very intense stories from throughout her life, and she really turned it into something that I think anyone reading gets an emotional connection to. Because even if your family story isn't as extreme as Jeanette's was, I think everyone can identify with having to grow up and learning to come to peace with where you were in your past and your story with your siblings and mistakes your parents made, but also the beautiful things your parents taught you. And I think that for Destin and I both, there was something about the spirit and the tone of the Glass Castle that spoke to us and reminded us of the spirit and the tone of our nickel winning script. The whole movie ultimately is from Jeanette's perspective. We also, and I think everyone involved in making it was very brave or willing to let us kind of play around with what you might traditionally expect, which I think is that you might create an entire fictional life story for Jeanette in the present, because a great deal of the book, I mean, most of the book happens in the past, not in the present. The present takes up a very small part of the book. We did create, or off of our interviews with Jeanette, we did kind of expound on some stuff in the present to create a framing device, but at least 2/3 of the movie takes place in the past, and Jeanette is played by Brie Larson, but also by two other amazing actresses in younger stages of her life. So over the first half, we kind of go back and forth from Brie to the younger versions, and then as the movie progresses and Jeanette comes of age, Brie's performance and her, like, the adult Jeanette kind of comes of age in the film as well, and then takes over the second half. But in terms of the characters, Woody and Naomi are kind of like the anchors, where the actors never change as they get older. They just run throughout the course of the film. In terms of adapting it overall, I think Destin and I both are of the opinion, and having done other adaptations now, I'm still of the opinion that it's more important to try to remain true to the spirit and the tone than specifically the sequential nature of events in the book. So I can't speak to if we pulled it off at all times, but our approach was very much to take in every scene, if you read the book closely, there might be 5 lines of dialogue from 5 different places in the book, or there might be a story in the book that takes place at a watering hole in the desert, and in the movie it takes place at a swimming pool. But there's another story from the book that takes place at a swimming pool. So there's, in every scene, there's a bunch of elements from the book that are kind of combined and adapted to try to turn it into a smoother narrative. we pitched the movie as a love story between Jeanette and her father, and that it was also with her siblings and with herself and with her mother, but that the overriding arc of the film would have to be that core love story between them. And in adapting it, we very much tried to model the structure of the book, which is the beginning feels intensely magical, and she's young, and she believes in all of the magic and all of the stories that her parents teach you. And then as she grows up, she starts to question that and starts to see the flaws and the pain that's kind of inherent in her parents' lives. And I think that that's, regardless of the extremity for other people, that's kind of a universal thing. And so our goal was always that the movie would model that as well and ultimately end up in the similar place that the book ends up, which is you're able to recognize all of the beauty and all of the magic from your childhood and all of the pain, and that all kind of coalesced into a greater understanding, which brings you to a greater understanding of yourself and allows you to kind of love your past, warts and all, so to speak, more fully. And I think that's the feeling the book gives the reader. I think that's why people respond to the book so intensely. And hopefully we at least come close to matching it in the film. I think for Glass Castle, we watched family films and some other films, but they're with the complicated structure that we pitched and the complicated nature of the story, it kind of necessitated just emulating the book. Like the book has so much incident in it and so many stories and so much happening that we essentially were just reading the book. I mean, I think both of us have probably read the book 15 times through by now. It wasn't the type of thing where you could go away and start writing and not continuously look at the book. So there weren't a lot of other movies that we could use as, oh, this is going to be like movie X and movie B, and we're going to combine these two, but it's going to be better than this or different than that. It was, it felt like its own thing.
Welcome to 93 Little Hobart Street. $50 a week, and in 2 years, we'll own her outright.
Hard to believe one day this will all be ours.
Hey, she may not look like much, but wait till you see what I have in mind. Come on, come on, come on. We're gonna tear all this down and replace it with your game room. Ping pong, pool, foosball.
Trampoline?
Oh yeah, trampoline goes right over there. And then all these walls are gone. Replaced with 3-inch glass, 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 glass. This can stay.
Doesn't that look lovely? Yellow stands for happiness and creativity.
This place doesn't have any running water or electricity.
Ignore her, she was born without vision.
Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv. Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. David McGee is an Academy Award-nominated screenwriter known for adapting the beloved novel by Jan Martel, Life of Pi. He also co-wrote the screenplay for Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day and Finding Neverland. His screen adaptation of Jan Martel's Life of Pi earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay and earned director Ang Lee an Oscar for Best Director. McGee is also the screenwriter for the next Chronicles of Narnia film, The Silver Chair, and is currently writing the screenplay for the Disney musical, Mary Poppins Returns. David McGee spoke with me at a special year-round event held in the Harry Ransom Center in 2013. Clips from this episode copyright Dune Entertainment 3 LLC, 20th Century Fox Film Corporation, and Miramax Film Corporation.
I began as an actor doing theater, and I lived in New York for a lot of years. I had a great time. I made no money. I traveled around and did regional theater and spent a lot of my time trying to find ways to support my acting habit. And as the result of that, I did a lot of voiceover. And I also narrated a lot of those audiobooks that you listen to in your car. When you go and listen to a book in your car, you can either listen to the full length, which is 10, 13 hours. It can be quite long. Or you can listen to the abridged version, which is about 3 hours. Someone has to abridge that book. And I went into the studio one day, and someone had abridged a novel that I was reading. And I said to the producers, this is terrible. I'm sorry, but the people in the book are teleporting as they're talking. They'd be in the kitchen talking, then they'd be in the backyard, then they'd flush the toilet. I mean, this was the worst abridgment I'd ever read in my life. And I said, I can do better than this. And they said, well, do you want to try? I mean, we'll pay you. And it wasn't a lot, but it was enough to keep me going. And I said, I'd do it. And so over the course of about 5 years, I abridged at least 85 novels. I don't know exactly what the number was. But I became an editor, essentially, taking other people's books apart. And what I was doing was taking a 105,000-word book, which runs for 12 hours, down to 29,500 words, which runs about 3 hours reading time, or approximately the length of a film script. So my job, my focus, was to pare away extraneous scenes and lengthy set descriptions, focus on dialogue and action, and what can be conveyed orally, as opposed to long passages where the narrator's reading what's going on in someone's head while they're driving on their way to the crime scene. You have to get to the crime scene. So without me realizing it, I was getting incredible training in structure. And I was working on romances, thrillers, bodice rippers, biographies, great books, terrible books. And I learned a healthy disrespect for writing. Which, when I always wanted to write, but I was a little scared of it. And I was treating words as too precious. And once you've cut up 85 other people's books, you start to feel a little less precious about your own words and a little more confident in your ability to think in the big picture. So that became my training. I wrote a play, which we did in a little theater on 42nd Street, and it was an actors and writers workshop. We just did stuff with each other. It was more for the few people who were in the space. We did my play, and I did it. Then I did another version of it, and then I was working with the woman who directed it, and she said she had another play from the workshop that she was trying to figure out how to make a film out of. I said, "What's it about?" And she said, "It's about this guy who wrote Peter Pan. He actually knew these kids. They were real inspirations for the Lost Boys." And I said, "Well, I can write that." And I would have said that if she talked about, you know, sanitation workers, but my. My initial thought was, well, that's a great, you know, that is a great premise for something. And so she said, well, read the play and see what you can do with it. And the original play was lovely, but it was very theatrical. It was James Barry talking to the audience, you know, life and the mystery of it and when we're all young and that sort of thing. And it took place over 30 or 40 years of his life. He grows old, and the boys who play the Lost Boys are actually men playing boys, and then by the end, they're grown up, and they've grown up and he hasn't. So it was a very different story. Only about two or three lines remained from what I wrote, but that was the inspiration for Finding Neverland, and I've been working as a screenwriter ever since. I have to say it was a matter of incredible dumb luck. I mean, I take credit for writing a good script, but what had happened was Alan Nee, who had done Little Women on Broadway and was the writer of the original play, had staged a version of The Man Who Was Peter Pan, which was the play he wrote, in a little theater of about 30 seats across the street from our workshop. And it happened to be reviewed in The Hollywood Reporter. And the people who run the studios read those reviews, and if anything unusual or interesting pops up, they circle it and they pass it around to each other and they give it to some junior assistant and say, track this, see what it is. And it caught the attention of Miramax. They tried to buy the rights for it, but by the time they did, Nellie had bought the rights from Alan for a dollar, and then I had got that dollar to write it. You know, so it was just, we had already had a contract. So they said, okay, well, see what you can do with it. And so I had them waiting to see what the script would look like. I, you know, got my dollar, and about 4.5-5 months later, I had a rushed first draft that I then shared with them. And based on that, they said, okay, yeah, we'll give you a shot to write this. Go, you know, we'll buy this script for, you know, a reasonable but modest amount, you know, for my first film, and we'll give you a shot at writing another draft. But it was another several years before Mark Forster, the director, came on board. But I didn't know if Neverland was ever going to be made. So Mark expressed interest early on, but then nothing happened for years. And then when Monsters Ball came out, that gave us, they said, what do you want to do? And he said, I told you, I want to do Finding Neverland. And that's how that happened. A lot of my take on this material came about because when I wrote this, I was, had only been married for a short time. I was, my first child was about to be born, and my father was in the end stages of cancer. And so, and I was an actor earning no money and trying to figure out how to take care of my family. So this was very much about what does it mean to grow up? And that was what I wrote on my, you know, chart when I was trying to figure out what this movie was about. And it was very much about a grown man who hasn't necessarily completely grown up and doesn't think that people should have to grow up in some way, who meets a family, including a young boy, who has had to grow up too quickly. And all of the other characters relate to that theme in some way, and the journey of this film is about those two characters crossing paths so that by the end they're sitting on a bench together and he's grown up and become a man and the boy is allowed to be a boy again.
Prince George, I gather. I understand you were the horrible tyrant who imprisoned this unfortunate wretch.
Not horrible, really, but a firm ruler, yes. Kind and tolerant.
And what precisely is, what did you say your name was?
Michael.
What precisely is Michael's crime?
He's my younger brother.
Ah, fair enough. Sorry, lad. Cannot free you.
That's all right. Do you mind just playing with your dog?
No, go on.
This is Jack, second in line to the throne.
Good dog.
And that one's Michael. He's only 5.
And I'm in prison for it.
So sorry, my boy's bothering you.
We're not bothering him, Mum.
Michael, darling, come out from under there.
I can't, I'm in prison.
Oh, I see.
Jay and Barry, pleased to meet you.
Jay and Barry, the author? A pleasure. Sylvia Llewellyn Davies.
You're a writer?
I am.
He's a playwright, Jack. Quite a famous one at that.
The original play took place over a much longer period of time, and one of the first things that I decided was I don't want to see three sets of boys play these characters over time. So I want to condense the action to one period of time. With that in mind, it should be the period in, you know, going up to the making of Peter Pan. Now, it's an interesting question in terms of doing a real person's story. How much do you play with the facts? Now, we did begin the film by saying this is based on a true story. We condensed time severely. The boys, the events that take place in our film actually took place over nearly a decade of time. And in fact, for those of you who are going to go see the movie tonight, they knew the father, or James knew the father, who has just passed away at the beginning of the film. And that's because we didn't want to have so many scenes of mortality in one film. And then the relationship that they took several years to develop actually takes place over one very long, intense summer. I don't think there's any question for anyone watching the film that we've taken liberties with the truth because there are, you know, boys flying around in the thing and there's, you know, fantasy sequences. But that's a decision that we made very early on. There is a big final scene in the movie when Sylvia, the mother, imagines Neverland, goes to Neverland.
I want you to go back to the theatre. Find Peter.
Of course.
Thank you.
You sure there's nothing else I can do for you?
No. Well, I have always wanted to go to Neverland. You did promise to tell me about it, you know.
They did.
It's a bit late for it tonight, though, I'm afraid. up sometime soon, though.
Most definitely.
In the first writing of the film, we were trying to find a way, I was trying to find a way to express that. And so they do a play in the living room. And then I had, at a certain point, when Peter Pan says, let's fly away, she found her chair being lifted up and some people from the theater were carrying her out to the backyard where they had set up some of the scenery from Finding Neverland, from Peter Pan, so that we would see that they had gone to special effort to make it magical for her. And that's all I thought we were ever going to be able to afford. That was the big one for me, was we were going to open some doors and set her outside, and she was going to be able to experience that, and then we'd see the look on her face, and it would be this glorious, you know, scene. Well, of course, as soon as I turned it into the studio, they said, this is great, but make it bigger, which you never hear, because I had been very constrained, and my little fantasies were just kind of, and he dances with the dog, he dances with a bear, he imagines himself dancing with a bear, and I saw this little, you know, moment, maybe where he's dancing with a guy in a bear outfit or something. I thought we could get away with that.
With just a wee bit of imagination, I can turn around right now and see the great bear, Porthos. Dance with me.
And they said, no, let's put it in a circus tent with people all around, and it's a big, okay. Let's make it bigger, that's fine by me. So it was a question of really expanding on what I had already done. But that sense was in there. So I had never been to London when I wrote the script. And I looked up where the play took place. The opening night play, which is at the beginning of the film, it takes place at the Prince of Wales Theater. So I said, okay, well, what's a Prince of Wales Theater look like? Well, I imagine it has a big lobby. And so I, you know, I wrote the big lobby scene, and then I wrote another scene. And like, they went over to do... they went over to do a scene, you know, to pick out sets and things, and they came back and they said, Dave, there's no real lobby in that theater. It's about the size of this stage right here, and that's it. And I said, yeah, well, we can change it, you know. At that point, you'd already bought it from me, so I could say, yeah, I had never been there. So they were filming the script that we had agreed upon. So I was spending a lot of time hanging around feeling like a third wheel and you know, sitting in the corner. And a friend of mine had recommended Life of Pi to me as a good book and said, you know, stick with it. First 100 pages, kind of philosophical and slow, but it gets really good. So I read it. I had a wonderful time reading it. I went up to Mark Forster, who was busy making a film, for God's sake, and I said, hey, I got a good book you should read. He said, is it a movie? And I said, no, it's too hard. But it's a good book. And then I felt stupid because I was like, I'm telling him to read a book. He's got other stuff to do. So I never thought of it again. I just walked away, and that was the last I'd heard of it until 4 years ago when my agent called and said, have you read Life of Pi? And I said, yeah, that's a hard one. And he said, Ang Lee wants to do it. And I said, sounds great. It sounds good. Let's do it. So the... first thing that we talked about was, what is this story about? What is this film about? What's the focus? What's the center? Because there are a lot of ideas that are kind of thrown around in that book that don't necessarily go all in the same direction. Rich ideas that don't necessarily focus into one idea. And when you're abridging, when you're concentrating your filmmaking into 2 hours, you have to focus on the themes that are most important to you. So we agreed from the very beginning that this was a story about storytelling, about the power of stories to help us through our lives, to overcome the difficulties that we face in our lives, about how we all have different narratives, some religious, some spiritual, some atheistic, scientific ways of understanding the world that you have to like rely on when you find yourself in a difficult situation. You have to step back and say, okay, this is what's at work These are the forces that are at work. And as long as I respect those forces and understand them and deal with them, I can get through this. Mm-hmm. And that was what Pi was for us very much about. On the other hand, there is a preface to the book that's written in the first person as though Jan Martel is writing about why he came to write this book. And he says, I was in despair over the fact that my last book, fell apart. I abandoned the manuscript. I was wandering through India trying to figure out what to do next, and I met a man in a cafe who told me that he knew a man who could tell you a story that would make you believe in God. Now, it was fictionalized, but it feels like it's very much the real writer, Jan Martel. That scene is never returned to in the book, but we wanted to write about storytelling and storytellers. And so from the very beginning, it was Aang had determined this before he even talked to me. He wanted to have the storyteller framing device that you see in the film, where we see the adult Pi, an accomplished yarn spinner, talking to a writer, another storyteller, and passing a story along. So that became the framework for the film.
So I was sitting in this coffee house in Pondicherry one afternoon, mourning my loss, and this old man at the table next to me struck up a conversation.
Yeah, Mamaji, he does that.
When I told him about my abandoned book, he said, "So, a Canadian who's come to French India in search of a story. Well, my friend, I know an Indian in French Canada with the most incredible story to tell. It must be fate that the two of you should meet."
Well, I haven't spoken about Richard Parker in so many years. So what has Mamaji already told you?
He said you had a story that would make me believe in God.
He would say that about a nice meal. As for God, I can only tell you my story. You'll decide for yourself what you believe.
Fair enough.
Let's see then where to begin.
And what we wanted to emphasize was this kind of coming of age, a boy who is willing to accept every narrative that comes to him because he hungers for learning, and then reaches a point where he's disillusioned by them all, which was kind of our own version of the first act. For us, the beginning of the book was probably the hardest to bring to the film. So we made the mother, the Hindu, faithful. We made the father, the atheist. We kept the priest who was in there, who would be part of that journey. And then we had him visit a mosque at one point. So we restructured it so you could condense all of that into a very few scenes, but you would still see that he was taking all of those things in.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. Tune in to next week's On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI when we hear from Chase Palmer, co-writer of the brand new Stephen King adaptation, It, which arrives in theaters September 8th.
I think one of the reasons this movie right now feels like it's going to cross over from a horror audience to a wider audience is because everybody has gone through this. Everyone's had their summer break and had their new friends and been a kid and had a first love and felt rejected and felt like a loser, you know, in regards to other people. And that is what makes this particular movie and this story unique.
We'll also feature a 1996 discussion from the Austin Film Festival Vault with horror legends Wes Craven and Tobe Hooper discussing the influences from their most terrifying films.
Nightmare on Elm Street, I always thought it was an embodiment of the concept of the sins of the parents will be visited on the children, and an exploration of consciousness.
Mine was my relatives scaring the hell out of me. They lived in Wisconsin, about 20 miles away from Ed Gein. Chainsaw has the reputation of really being a story about Ed Gein, so does Psycho. But in Chainsaw, it was my relatives scaring the hell out of me and giving me these bits and pieces that I found out years after making the film. Well, this is a film about Ed Gein.
Wes Craven died in 2015, and Tobe Hooper passed away this August. Get a look inside the creative process with On Story on your local public radio station. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Life of Pi and Finding Neverland screenwriter David McGee discussing writing for imaginative worlds and using language to articulate enchanting stories.
Listen. Instead of leaping from one religion to the next, why not start with reason? In a few hundred years, science has taken us farther in understanding the universe than the religion has in 10,000.
That is true. Your father is right. Science can teach us more about what is out there, but not what is in here.
Yeah, some eat meat, some eat vegetable. I do not expect us all to agree about everything, but I'd much rather have you believe in something I don't agree with than to accept everything blindly. And that begins with thinking rationally. Do you understand?
Structurally, in the book, there's a scene that's played for comedy where he's a young boy and the father wants to teach him that animals are dangerous. So he says, come see this tiger. It wasn't Richard Parker. And we're going to feed the tiger a goat. And they watch the tiger eat the goat. And they're kind of faintly horrified. And then he says, now, what about an antelope? And is an antelope safe? No, an antelope has horns that can spear you. What about a zebra? A zebra can kick you to death. What about it? And he goes through dozens of animals until he finally gets to a bunny. And he says, what about a bunny? Okay, a bunny's safe. And that's kind of the tone of it. We wanted to turn that into a real disillusionment. That he reaches the age of around 12 or 13, he thinks the world is safe, the world is like this zoo, everything is wonderful and protected. And then one day he meets the tiger and he realizes there's a harsh, cruel world out there that he's never been introduced to. And we called that our bar mitzvah scene, in a sense. And so it's played not for humor, it's played for the intensity and for the kind of break in relationship he has with his father at that moment, who is the rationalist, who is the scientist, who basically says, you think everything's a dream, you think everything's a party, you think it's all, you know, you think that animal has a soul? No, that animal will eat you. That animal doesn't care anything about you. If you think there's anything in that animal's eyes, it's something you made up.
Animals do not think like we do. People who forget that get themselves killed. That tiger is not your friend. When you look into his eyes, you are seeing your own emotions reflected back at you. Nothing else.
Don't be stupid. Say you're sorry.
What have you done, Vaseen? You know what your father said about coming back here?
I am sorry.
And that becomes kind of something that he needs to understand for himself and prove for himself over the course of the journey. So that's a way in which a specific scene was tailored to the film in order to give shape to the first act and action to the first act, so you would feel like you were being told a narrative, an action narrative, rather than kind of an abstract, interesting, but, you know, a novelistic approach to kind of exploring ideas for a book. Well, Aang suggested, what if we do the three acts as completely looking different filmically, everything different about them? So the first act takes place in kind of a romantic India. The second act takes place in something completely different at sea. And the third act takes place in yet another mode. Now, we pulled away from that. But in the course of that conversation, we said, well, all right, let's try. And because there's so much exposition, there's so much that has to be explained. Let's try doing the second act without any dialogue at all. And that's all the time at sea. From the moment the shipwreck happens until he gets to shore, let's try and write the whole thing without a word of dialogue. Just actions, you know, figuring out all the actions that we could do to tell the story. And that's how we wrote it. The first act we wrote as a split-page document with the modern-day scene going on the left and the flashbacks to when he was a boy on the right, which is a real hassle to write. In Microsoft Word. I can just, as a side note, they don't have a computer program to do that. And every time I made a change to one side of the page, the whole thing would shift. It was a nightmare. But the whole first act was written that way. And the second act was written without any dialogue at all. And the third act then was written back in that split page format. And gradually we came to realize that I think I was trying to prove to myself as a writer that I didn't need voiceover, because it's a truism in screenwriting to a lot of people that you shouldn't use voiceover. And so I was trying to prove I didn't need to. But I got to a certain point where I said, now I've proved that I can convey what's happening. But what we're missing is what the boy's experiencing emotionally as a result, where his thoughts are taking him. So at that point, we started bringing voiceover in. And it's only natural, if you've got an animal in a boat with you, whatever animal it is, you're going to talk to it. So it became almost forced and artificial if he was like looking at the tiger and going, you know, he wasn't actually. So then we had him actually talking to the tiger, and that felt very natural. So it was only gradually that we brought out the voice in that character.
Here, Richard Parker. I got some water for you.
In the zoo, we fed our tigers an average of 5 kilos of meat a day. Richard Parker will be getting hungry soon. Tigers are powerful swimmers, and if he gets hungry enough, I'm afraid the little bit of water between us won't be any protection. I need to find a way to feed him. I can eat the biscuits, but God made tigers carnivores, so I must learn to catch fish. If I don't, I'm afraid his last meal will be a skinny vegetarian boy.
The process of taking someone else's work, in some ways it's more freeing because you can see what you like and what you don't. You can have strong opinions and you can begin being very critical. You can say, that doesn't work, throw it away, this, that, you know, just toss things over your shoulder. I like these 9 scenes. I'd put this one here and here and here, and we'll have to rewrite that. You can be very cruel in your assessment of someone else's work. When you're starting from scratch, it's not a reductive process. It's a let's just keep throwing ideas out and getting it bigger and bigger and creating a lump of clay you can mold. So you don't start with the critical mind working as much. You're really trying to run as fast as you can, throwing ideas out in a lot of directions so that then you can come back later and see what sticks. It's very hard as a writer of a new work if you start with the head of, this has got to be perfect the first, you know, this has got to be, you know, I got to map it out the first time, you know. So and on one hand, it's much more freeing to throw 1,000 ideas on the table. But on the other hand, it's much nicer to have someone say, no, I've already figured out this much. Start from here, you know.
So what did Jan Martel think of the final film?
When Aang and I began, Aang had talked to Jan before I came on and introduced himself. And then Aang and I sat down, and one of the earliest questions was to me, do you want to meet with Jan? And I said, I don't know, do I? I mean, do you think it will help? And he said, well, I don't know. He's a novelist. And I said, then no, I don't want to meet him. I don't want to talk to him. No insult to him. But when you are taking apart someone else's book, it's hard for them to look over your shoulder as you're ripping chapters out and throwing them, you know, away. Or when you're saying, this is important, and I don't like that scene, you know, which you have to be able to do to figure out your own way to do it. And we had to spend 9 months. We went to India together, Aang and I did, and we went and met a shipwreck survivor, Steve Callahan, who had survived for 76 days at sea in a 5-foot round inflatable raft, and talked to him about that experience. And those things came in and informed what we were writing. And he actually became our technical consultant on the film. We were, in a sense, creating our own journey out of this. And to have someone else who already had gone on their own journey through this material would have been counterproductive. Once we had a draft that we liked enough to show the studio and get some notes from them after 9 months, we went into a second draft very quickly, and 2 or 3 months later we were done with a second draft, and we showed that to Jan. And at that point, he was very supportive. He had a lot of notes, some very specific, some very, you know, he was very concerned, for example, with how the pie interacted with the tiger physically. In his mind, Richard Parker was also a kind of a stand-in for his relationship with God, and if he got too casual with the tiger, or the tiger was treated with disrespect in any way, that was an insult to the way he felt it should be dealt with. So we accommodated those things. What we were focused on was the power of that faith and that story to help Pi on his narrative. And are you going to question his right to take that story and make that his reality when that's what helped him to survive? You know, and that was a more interesting question to me. So that at the end of the film, the writer, Pi says to the writer,
can I ask you something?
Of course.
I've told you two stories about what happened out on the ocean. Neither explains what caused the sinking of the ship. And no one can prove which story is true and which is not. In both stories, the ship sinks, my family dies, and I suffer.
True.
So which story do you prefer?
The one with the tiger. That's the better story.
Aang saw the 3D of this film in a proscenium style, essentially, which is a traditional theater window. So very few things actually come out at you. And he wanted you to feel as though you were watching in depth like a stage set. You know, this kind of beautiful landscape, but set back into things. So yes, there is an occasional at the beginning, a hummingbird zips out towards you a little bit just to say, yeah, it's 3D. But what was more important was that we were aware, you know, as we were writing, that certain scenes would take advantage of the kind of depth and the kind of sculptural feel of it. It was much more, it was a learning process for all of us. And at the beginning, I was just trying to get the logic of the story worked out. Aang was thinking in 3D and trying to figure out what that meant from the beginning. And as we wrote, he would get ideas, because we worked back and forth constantly. And so I would write a scene, say the shipwreck sinking. And I would say, okay, here's what happens in the scene. The zebra jumps off, lands on the boat, the rope breaks, he falls again, he hits the water, and gets swept away. And Aang would take that and he'd go, okay, but I want him to fall into the water because I want to have him hanging in the water looking as the ship sinks. I want him to be able to see that so that we feel that moment. I'd say, okay, I put that in. And then I would come up with an idea on that, and he would throw something else back and forth. So as we evolved the script, as different ideas came in, there was no question that 3D was very much in Aang's mind, and I was aware of it. Once we actually went into pre-production, I was doing that second rewrite on the script, and Aang began working with computer graphic artists who mapped out every scene from the shipwreck to the landing on the island in computer form, in 2D, but with an eye to where the camera angles would be, I knew exactly what the whole second act looked like by the time we were ready to start shooting. I knew shot for shot what he was going to do. So again, I would come in and I'd watch what he was doing. I would copy that in the script. I would make other changes based on dialogue issues we made, and he would go off and change that animatic. So it was an evolving process. Because I grew up in the theater, I have a very strong respect for the director's relationship with the actor and not coming between that. So, as an example, the man who played the father in Pi wanted to make changes to the lines. I was happy to listen to his changes, but I wanted to talk it over with Aang first before I agreed to any of them. And he basically said, do whatever you think is right. And I was fine then to go off and do that. I don't ever give actors line readings, though, because that's the purview of the director. And if inadvertently the director says, do it this way, and I come in and say, do it the other way, I'm undermining his authority and causing the actor to question, you know, what it is he's doing. So I would never do that. Now, there have been occasions with directors where I've kind of gone to the side and said, that doesn't work, that don't fix that, you know, but I would never say it directly to the actor. That said, on Life of Pi, Suraj, the boy, had never acted before. And he didn't know how to swim. So he was as green as they come. So he arrived several months in advance of shooting. And I kind of became his drama teacher a little bit. Because Aang's busy, you know, and I'm writing, but I'm also finding scripts for him to read and talking about it. And then Aang and I picked out some scenes from other plays, including some Edward Albee Zoo story, that sort of thing, where he could be directed by Aang in material that had nothing to do with our script, with our lines. We didn't want to get something stuck in his head about how he had to perform something. But so he could work with him as a director. and I was the other actor. I played the other role, and Aang then coached both of us. So I was working with the actor. I was always very careful not to intercede when it came to how the actual line should be delivered. Life of Pi was very abstract in sections. It was very philosophical in sections. I loved sections of it, and I wasn't so sure about sections of it. Sorry, Jan, if you're listening. I was not, you know, there were parts I was not as fond of, and I didn't know how it would translate to the screen, particularly when it was going to be so expensive to make. Because no matter how you do this, you've got a tiger in a boat with a boy, and you can't put a tiger in a boat with a boy unless it's the last day of shooting, and you don't care about the boy. So there's going to be a lot of trickery, there's going to be a lot of special effects, and there's going to be a lot of animals, and that's all expensive. So justifying that didn't make sense to me. But the moment that I knew Ang Lee wanted to do it, I mean, I say it in a joking way, but it's very true. If Ang Lee can make it as visually wonderful and intense as Ang Lee can do, then I have no doubt we can find a way to pull this off. Or if we can't, who's going to blame us? You know, we'll try, we won't get the script, and they've tried several other times to make this into a film, and it hasn't worked. So I get to work with Ang Lee, you know, so that was the decision.
And so Richard Parker went ahead of me. He stretched his legs and walked along the shore. At the edge of the jungle, he stopped. I was certain he was going to look back at me, flatten his ears to his head, growl, that he would bring our relationship to an end in some way. But he just stared ahead into the jungle. And then Richard Parker, my fierce companion, the terrible one who kept me alive, disappeared forever from my life.
Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment of the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing from Brian Ramos and Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more from the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October.
PRI, Public Radio International.